Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. How's life so far under President Donald Trump in the US? By the time you hear this, he'll probably already have started a war on illegal immigrants, have that well underway in America, and he may already have begun his trade war on the rest of humanity, whom he accuses of living off American largesse. There's nothing to be done about Donald Trump, except, I think, to sit back and watch and thank your lucky stars you know, as far away from the action as most listeners will be as possible. And in response, I guess, as a country, we need to be as agile and self-reliant as possible. Who knows? Trump may even decide he likes us. One of the ways we become agile is to fix the things that we've broken here or that have been broken here. Electricity was one, and now that's largely up and running again. And next up seems to be logistics. Logistics is a cute way of talking about moving goods around on trucks and trains. Our railways are, frankly, buggered. Transnet, this Spoornet of old, managed to move just 152 million tons of freight in 22 and 24, well down from the 226 million tons it did just 6 years earlier in 2017 and 2018. The still new Transport Minister, Barbara Creasy, released to much acclaim something called the Network Statement a few weeks ago. It's a huge document that explains in detail how a rail system works. One of the first people to read it would have been my guest on this podcast, Jamie Holly. He's the CEO of Traction, a rail services company. And if you've not heard of them, it's probably because it does most of its work in the rest of Africa and not here. Jamie, welcome to the podcast. And if you don't mind, I'm going to read a few lines of introduction on the Traction website and ask you to tell us more about it. The website says, for more than three decades, we've been delivering class-leading rail solutions in sub-Saharan Africa. Our deep financial capacity enables us to invest in new rolling stock in track infrastructure projects, resulting in us bringing meaningful rail solutions to our customers. We're passionate about all things rail, but above all, we're committed to bringing fresh prospects, progress, and new horizons to the people of Africa. So, Jamie, we'll come back to the South African rail story in a minute. But next to that statement is a photograph of a row of absolutely fabulous-looking bright red trains. And first of all, are those trains yours? And if they are, what do you do with them in the rest of Africa?
Peter, thanks. And thank you for having me on the podcast today. Yes, those are our trains. We own a fleet of about 60 odd locomotives. And then in addition to that, we service about another 50 locomotives. So we touch more than 110 locomotives on a daily basis. We currently have boots on the ground in seven countries, and very shortly, in fact, by March, we'll have boots on the ground in nine countries in the region. And we use those trains to move freight, move rail freight. We don't move passengers. We concentrate only on rail freight. We've been doing it for more than three decades. We really pride ourselves in delivering very high quality rail services in very difficult jurisdictions.
Give me an example. So where are you busiest in the rest in Africa at the moment?
A really nice example is a copper train that we run out of the DRC and the Zambian copper belt. There are various different elements, and it's an example of the trains that we run, but this train is a nice example of what we do. And we invested in new trains, so new locomotives and new wagons. So we have very high-quality locomotives and very high-quality wagons. And we put them into a service that operates 1,850 kilometers from Ndola, which is the kind of logistics heart of the DRC and Zambian copper belt, all the way to the port of Dar es Salaam. And we have access agreements, very similar to what's coming in South Africa, where we pay for access onto the state network, like toll fees, like we pay for toll fees on the N3. And we pay to utilize the line. And then our crews sleep on the train. So we have a caboose that moves, a sleeper caboose that moves with the train. So now we have high-quality locomotives. We have a crew that stays with the train, so we don't have crewing issues. We've got high-quality wagons. We're the only ISO 9001 certified operator that I know of on the continent, so we have very good processes and procedures. We're very good people, invest a lot into parts. And so we achieve extremely high reliability across our trains. Even though the infrastructure conditions aren't great and the trains go pretty slow, because our rail freight is pre-cleared and because we don't have many breakdowns, our trains generally achieve transit times faster than trucks. So we run 30 wagon trains. Each wagon moves about 57 tons of copper, so more than 1,500 tons of copper per train. And we move copper out and then mining reagents back from Dar es Salaam. We work very closely with our customers. They know exactly when our trains are arriving. And they stuff in, they pre-stuff containers before our arrival. They pre-cut customs documents. Our trains are import for a very short period of time. They get loaded and then they depart. And it's an amazing collaboration between the public sector, which is the governments of Tanzania and Zambia that have provided us access through the Chisara rail system, and the private sector, our customers, who are the freight forwarders who consolidate freight for us on both sides and then load and offload our trains really efficiently. So, and ultimately, it's not without its challenges, of course, but we've been running that service now for about 5 years. And we've generated tens of millions of dollars of revenue to the Tanzanian and Zambian government through Chisara in the form of these access charges. It's really the pioneer of that service. But what's interesting is that the whole way that that trains are run in the region is changing very fast. You know, 6 or 7 years ago, we were only in 2 countries, South Africa and Mozambique. And as I said earlier, we're now into 9 countries. So the way the trains move is changing, with more and more countries opening up their tracks to allow the private sector operators like ourselves to start to run trains.
So you would have won the Ndola Dar es Salaam concession in a tender, or how does it work? How do you get the work? How do you get the job?
So we applied for access. It's an application. So you know the difference between tendering to supply locomotives to a state railway. Okay, that's a tender process. This is different. Okay. It's an application process. We apply for it, and it's very similar to what's going to be what we'll have in future in South Africa, where as long as the network capacity exists and as long as you have the capacity to deliver it, and you apply for the slots and you come and run your trains.
Yeah. And so are there other private companies on the same track as you are, doing the same job as you are between Ndola and Dar?
Yes, there is. They've actually allocated another 2 slots to, or not slots, they've allocated access rights to another 2 operate subsequent to the initiation of our train service with it. And you know, really, rail systems are heavy fixed cost businesses. There's a very high degree of, firstly, the capital costs in our industry are huge. So your financing costs, if you have to finance infrastructure, is very high because of the capital costs. But then there's also a very high degree of maintenance that you have to perform no matter how much tonnage is moved across the system. The more volumes, ultimately, that you can move across the railway system, the better it is for the ultimate feasibility of the system. It's a cycle of success that becomes self-fulfilling, if you want. Of course, it works the other way too. And so, you know, the more you see private sector operators entering into the system, the more we actually succeed together.
Does the same apply throughout Africa, the other 7 or 8 countries that you work in? You've applied, and there are other privately owned rail operators or train operators on the same tracks as you, doing more or less the same job. It's a competitive business, and it's continent-wide, right?
More and more so becoming continent-wide, Peter. I mean, as I said, you know, 6, 7 years ago, Mozambique had implemented it. They were the first. And we didn't have the rights to operate our trains outside of Mozambique. But more and more countries are implementing it now, to the extent that we are in 9 countries.
And you're able to run this from Johannesburg or from Gauteng?
Yes, we are a very proudly South African business. Our main workshop complex is in Rosslyn in Pretoria. Our safety and compliance team sits in Rosslyn, Pretoria. Our rail training center, which is South African government certified, by the way. So you know, when people leave our training center, they actually leave with a South African government certificate. Our administration is all based in South Africa, but we earn the vast majority of our revenue outside of South Africa in regional operations.
And as a matter of interest, your train sets are made where? Do you have are they Chinese, Indian, German, Canadian? Where do you buy your kit from?
The market leaders in diesel, we call it diesel electric locomotives, but diesel locomotives are the Americans. The General Electric originally General Electric and General Motors. The successors in title are now Webtec and Progress Rail. They have historically manufactured the highest quality diesel locomotives in the world. The vast majority of diesel locomotives on the continent of Africa are either GM or GE originally. A lot of them actually, Peter, interestingly, were assembled in South Africa. It makes a lot of sense to assemble locomotives in the country because they're very big assets that are very heavy and very heavy to ship.
Yeah.
The original parts originate by and large.
So you've got have you assembled these trains yourself, or do you have them assembled?
Yeah, we very specifically are an operator of trains, and owner operator and service and we service trains. We distribute parts of it as well. Across the continent. For another revenue stream, but we are an operator and we service trains. We don't want to get into the manufacturing of locomotives or wagons. It's a very, very different business. To what we focused on.
Just educate me though. Who did assemble your trains, and who in South Africa assembles trains that aren't, say, Transnet's trains?
So we've assembled locomotives for more than 100 years in South Africa. In fact, interestingly, my great grandfather immigrated from America to South Africa to manufacture locomotives in Boksburg.
There you go.
His name was Charles. Yeah, and he used to manufacture a shunting locomotive called the Flanky locomotive. It's still actually quite a lot of them still exist. But so we have assembled locomotives in South Africa for more than 100 years.
And is this done privately or done by the state?
It was historically done privately through DCD Dorval and Boksburg and Union Carriage Awards and Rigel. But really, from the advent of the 1064 procurement program, the locomotives have been assembled by Transnet.
Yeah.
Freight locomotives have been assembled by Transnet. Yeah. Passenger Rail, of course, have Alstom and the Gubetta consortium.
Yeah. So, you know, I grew up in a small town in South Africa, Mthatha, in the Transkei, and I've always had this kind of, I suppose, sort of romantic, boyish relationship with locomotives and trains. I remember the sound of the daily train coming into the station from East London. There was one train a day. And when I was younger, my dad would drive us out of town to a particular part of the track, which came very close to what is now the N2. And we would know what time more or less the train was arriving, and there would be arrive at sort of 2:30 on a Sunday, whatever it might be. And the guy in the train would lean out and wave as we, you know, as we hooted or whatever we did as the train came past. I mean, it is quite a romantic, it's got a romantic image, I suppose, in many people's minds. How complicated and how difficult a business is it?
It's an extremely complex industry to be a part of. Okay, the locomotives are a very robust asset. They last for a very long period of time, but they require extremely strict maintenance regimes to stand behind them. We have a vast number of suppliers in South Africa. There is a relatively strong rail industry in South Africa. It's under extreme duress, of course, because of the dropping in tonnages and passenger movements, which has cut back on the procurement to South Africa and the amount of revenue that comes into the downstream industry. So it is under duress, but there still is got a number of very strong suppliers in South Africa. But we also have to procure parts from around the world. So we have these very complex supply chains of parts that come from around the world into South Africa and then distributed across the various countries where we work. And so, you know, from a supply chain perspective, it's complex. Then we've got a huge skills deficit in our industry. So, you know, in response to the skills deficit, we had to 20 years ago, we started a rail training center within Traction. We've spent a lot of time in getting that government certified. So we've trained more than 700 drivers and more than 50 what we call Red Seal technicians, which is the highest level of technical training you can attain in South Africa. So we can try to solve some of that problem ourselves. And then, you know, from a process and procedure perspective, in order to maintain standards across your various geographically dispersed operations, a focus on process and procedures is fundamental. So we've got more than 14,000 control documents that we use to operate our business on a daily basis. And then you've got regulations. So, particularly in South Africa for our various South African sites, we operate private closed networks in South Africa, like for the gold mining industry, for example, between shafts and processing plants or shunting services for miners, preparing trains for transit to come and collect it. And the regulation is extremely high in South Africa. So the safety regulation is very, very strong. But of course, that also requires, that adds a level of complexity to your business. So it's not only just understanding these complex machines. There is a level of complexity to it. But you know what you opened with is the romance of the industry. You know, and I mean, I came into this industry 16 years ago. I was a chartered accountant who wanted to become a banker who realized this mistake early, and I found my way into the railway industry. And you know, coming in cold into the industry, it's incredible to see the affection that people hold within the industry for the railways and rail industry.
No, absolutely. And I clearly remember my father was a building contractor in Mthatha, and he wasn't in the 50s and 60s. He couldn't even go to his son and bring back a bag of nails in his car. It had to come by train. And he was, you know, he was a law-abiding citizen and didn't want to get stopped and, you know, somebody to find the bag of nails sitting on the back of the car, because it was a very strict affair. People, the Nats or the old nationalist government, really did look after South African Railway Service in a way perhaps that in the new sort of, you know, not democratic but sort of less regulated world, we forgot about. You were talking about skills and your own school in the company. Is it difficult to find people to? I mean, I imagine, first of all, I imagine it must be not only enormously complex running a train itself, but running a rail system just blows. I can't get my head around it. How do you, you know, you've got a million variations of goods, where they're going, what track they're on, when they've got to go, what they have to join up with. What kind of person does that well? Who does that well in the world? And how well, where are we fit? I mean, I know that our system is broken, but are our people broken as well? Or do we have the skills?
Peter, you know, the railways is one of the oldest industries in the industrial world that is still as relevant today as it was back then. Okay. You know, sure, if you look at the sort of global benchmarks as to how straight rail doing, well, you know, in the 20 years leading up to 2020, rail freight increased by 79% across the world. Okay, so more and more tons are moving, freight tons are moving around the world all the time. So it's as relevant as it's always been. Okay, and then you say, well, who is very good at doing this? Okay, and there's enormous precedent for rail systems that are really, really working. Okay. And you know, there's a kind of misconception that railways are railways, okay, but freight rail and passenger rail are very, very different industries within the rail industry, if I can say that, okay. And if you want to say, well, what is a passenger rail system that's working pretty well, okay? Well, the European passenger rail system, especially the long-haul system, the metro systems within the cities, those are working really well, okay. But it's a passenger-dominated market in Europe. Yes, there is freight rail, but it's a passenger-dominated market. If you want to say, well, where is straight rail really working? Well, then you go to the United States or North America, particularly the United States and Canada, and you look at places like Australia, where rail systems are really, really functioning to an extremely high degree of efficiency. And you know what's interesting about the railway industry is that if you go back 10 years. If you bought a locomotive 10 years ago, a diesel electric locomotive, or even an electric locomotive 10 years ago, the technology from the OEMs, the fundamental technology, the engine technology, your cooling system, brake system, etc., 10 years ago and today are extremely simple. Very, very few major breakthroughs in engine combustion and into your subcomponent parts. But where the huge advantages, the huge advancements have come. They're firstly, of course, into the telemetry systems across the locomotive with early warning signals into the maintenance of your machines and machine uptime and the performance of each component part. But to your question is, who runs the systems well? Well, I mean, there's huge examples around the world of systems that are run extremely efficiently. You know, I'm sure you know that in South Africa, from when you drive around, you see the rail traffic lights on either side of the rail tracks, okay? And, you know, those have largely been phased out around the world. And in the United States, for example, or North America, they run systems which include a system called positive train control, which is instead of the driver interacting with the signaling solutions around the track, the trains interact with each other. So you have computers within each train, and the computers interact with the central control system. So those trains are talking to each other all the time. And all that matters is the minimum following distance between the trains. And you can imagine with knowing exactly where your train is all the time, the trains talking to each other all the time, the following distance between trains gets much, much shorter. The transit times, because the trains stop, become much, much quicker. And the density of these networks becomes more and more, you know. And, you know, if you look at the efficiency of like the North American railways, where as a stock, as listed stocks, especially they're absolutely mega businesses, but as listed stocks that performed extremely well, Warren Buffett, of course, owns Burlington Northern, Santa Fe. And then in terms of the freight performance, it's been exceptional. You know, the Americans, interestingly, have lifted half of their rail track since 1980.
Oh, really?
But have doubled.
When you say lifted, they've replaced it.
No, they've removed it. Completely removed. They've removed half of their rail track. But they've doubled volumes. And that's how you make railways work. Big, heavy, fixed cost businesses with very big, heavy, higher cost machines. And it's the efficiency with what you use them that's the most important thing. It's doing more with less. And that's not a new rule. But what technology advancements have enabled within the railways is to achieve real densities on our systems. And in South Africa, we're still running very, very old dated systems. So there's a massive opportunity for us to take pieces from around the world and apply those systems. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how would you... So we have, according to the network statement, we've got 21,232 kilometers of line in South Africa, which sounds to me to be... you know, a fair amount. I assume that includes the lines that Prasa would run its trains on. But just give a person, you know, you've had experience, you know the industry well. Where are we in South Africa? How far off the mark are we? You know, people are now talking about rail as the savior of this economy. So we're going to re-energize this economy. We're going to start exporting more aggressively. We need to get our goods you know, from inland to markets overseas. And you know, we all know now, because we've seen the lines of trucks lining up on their way to Maputo or down the N3 to Durban. It's all terribly depressing. How deep in trouble is our system, and how much is it going to take, let alone what you as private train operator might do? How much work has Transnet got to do to get the system and the track and to get that right again, get trains that, as you say, talk to each other? When do we get to the level of what the Americans are doing?
So Peter, firstly, I mean, you know, we have to accept that we're in a crisis. And it's not me saying it's in a crisis. It's government that says we're in a crisis. Yeah. And the response to the fact that government says we're in a crisis, that creates something called the National Logistics Crisis Committee, which involves all stakeholders of government and the inter-ministerial committee that has been assembled in order to ensure that we can make decisions as quickly as possible to find the solutions to the problem that we face in the railway industry. The ultimate test, to my mind, as to where are we in terms of rail, the success or failure of a rail system, is what tonnages are we moving? As you said, and you know, in 2017-18, Transnet did 226 million tons. And last year that 152, and in the half year they did 78, so they're tending towards, I think things are flipping sideways. So hopefully they get to 160 million tons, but the current run rate is 56, so you know, more or less where we were last year. And that's the ultimate test, is how much volume is moving across the system. But really, where we find ourselves today in South Africa, we've got two problems. Okay, we've got a shortage of trains in terms of trains that can move the freight demand that there is from the upstream economy. And of course, that not moving of the freight is what's constraining growth. You've got the Gain Institute, Stellenbosch, that says it's about 5% of GDP is their estimation of what the impact is. And then you've got a shortage of trains, and you've got a network that is in poor condition. Okay. And again, it's not me that says the network's in poor condition. Yeah. It's, Frankly, no. Logistics roadmap, it's the national rail policy, transit themselves, it's weather networks in poor condition. So we need to find two solutions in South Africa. We need to get more trains running, and we need to upgrade the condition of the fundamental infrastructure.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you get into the rail reform journey that the Department of Transport has embarked on. Okay. And this is when the story starts to get good, because to my mind, they've done an enormous amount of work in a short period of time. And it all started with the National Rail Policy. And that was approved in 2022. The National Rail Policy said that you need to see the vertical separation of Transnet freight rail between infrastructure. So that's your tracks, your sleepers, your ballast, tumbles, overhead lines. And train operating companies, and the train operating company, which is your trains, your wagons, your maintenance of the train, etc. Okay, so you have vertical separation between. And now we've seen the implementation of that between Transnet Infrastructure Manager and the train operating company. But that policy set the direction in stone, and the policy was very important because it created alignment in government amongst government and into the private sector as to what government's going to do with the railway. So it was very important to have the policy. Okay.
Yeah.
After the policy, we saw. And the implementation of the Regulation of Transport Bill, okay, and that creates the rail the single transport economic regulator, and as a subset of that, we have a rail economic regulator. So, but why is a rail economic regulator important? If you look anywhere in the world that has had the successful rollout of the implementation of private trains, onto a national rail system, rail economic regulation is very, very important. And if you go back to when the first network statement was released last year and the tariff came in at 19.7 cents, okay, and with the network statement that was released just before Christmas, we had a single tariff across the whole network, you've seen a huge advancement now because the regulator was involved with setting the tariffs, okay?
Okay.
The tariffs that we've now got, tariffs that are in most cases 50% reduced and in some cases more. Okay.
Yeah.
And they also are now multi-tiered. So it's not just one size fits all. We've got a now multi-tiered tariff, which also makes a lot of sense. The tariff methodology makes a lot of sense. So that regulation is vital. And the regulation was finally passed into law just before the last election. And it was interesting because it received almost no media uptime because I think everybody was watching the election. It was probably the most important moment South Africa's railway history is the implementation of the regulator.
Jamie, the regulator is the infrastructure manager. Is that the same thing or is that a different?
No, the rail economic regulator is completely independent of Transnet. It sits in the Department of Transport. At the moment, we've got an interim regulator and then in the process of establishing the final regulator. Yeah. Okay. So completely independent of the private sector, completely independent of Transnet. And they are the ultimate arbitrator in terms of disputes that we may have. So as the private sector with the transit infrastructure managers to impact conditions and time.
Yeah.
So very, very important moment, the release of that. And for the long-term success, that was very important. We've also seen other approvals by Parliament. And two very important pieces, two other very important approvals were the Freight Logistics Roadmap, which sets out the process of the implementation of the reform. And the PSP framework, the private sector participation framework, which has established a private sector participation unit, which is now then, together with guidance from the Freight Logistics Roadmap, to solve the second problem, okay, which is the quality of the infrastructure. The government and the Treasury has been quite clear that they don't intend in bailing out Transnet, and they're not going to provide massive bailouts for the upliftment of the quality of the infrastructure. Which means that, given Transnet's financial duress, being a breach of the cash interest cover ratio, for example, under the existing debt, you need to turn to the private sector and private sector participation projects to look into the upliftment of the quality of the infrastructure. And this PSP unit, the idea again behind that, completely independent of Transnet, to look and design and structure the right PSP projects to see the investment and by the private sector to come and uplift the condition of the infrastructure.
Is the private sector is going to be providing new trains? Are they also at the same time as doing that going to fund new track? In other words, new systems along the track, safety and lights and signaling and whatever might be. You're not going to be expected to do that. I mean, does the government or does Transnet turn to non-train operators to rebuild the system.
Yeah, absolutely right, Peter. By definition, that's correct. So you'd have train operating companies like ourselves, operator trains, and then you'd have infrastructure type investors, like the N3 investors, for example. Okay.
Yeah.
And or the N1 or toll investors and concessionaires that come and they invest into the infrastructure and they uplift the condition of the infrastructure. And then they operate for an extended period of time thereafter to earn the investment back and to earn a return on their investment. It's not over the whole network. The South African rail network is absolutely vast. About 40% of Africa's rail track sits in South Africa. Okay, so we've got a vast network. It would be almost inconceivable that the whole network would be concessioned. But for strategic sections of the network to be to be concessioned for significant investment, I mean, we're talking 15 billion rand onto, for example, the Johannesburg and Durban line, which is my estimation of what it would need to be upgraded. And, you know, it's a big investment, but at the same time, those are small fractions of what it would cost to replace and rebuild the network from scratch.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I mean, so just in the interest of clarity and transparency, you and I work for the same chairman in our various roles. It's Tsepo Mashlele, and he's a big investor in infrastructure in Africa, and an ambition, and has, I'm sure, as you found, you know, big ambitions for your own company. Just help me a little bit. Help me understand then. So the network statement that came out just before Christmas, Barbara Creasy, it describes a seriously sort of dystopian situation where South Africa has these basically six or seven big corridors, rail corridors, north, the northern one, there's a container one, the Cape one. And these are all helpful in understanding how bits of the network fit in with each other. I'm sure all the corridors cross with each other all the time. Is the idea then that the upliftment of the quality of the network, not so much the trains still for the moment, entirely up to, so also entirely up to private or developmental capital in some way? So you're going to go to the African Development Bank, or whose job is it to see to that? Is it Transnet's job, or is it Transnet's got to go out and find the money to fix the line between Durban and Cape Town? Because if you look at the network statement, just the corridor, I think it was the northern corridor, which was basically big export ore carrying stuff to Richards Bay, partly through countries to the north, Zimbabwe as well. But it was saying it would need just 3 billion rand worth of maintenance a year. Just maintenance, not, you know, according to the network statement, 3 billion rand worth of maintenance a year. That's a hell of a lot of money just to maintain something. I mean, how confident are you that this can all be done?
You know, I'm extremely confident that it can be done. I think that, like I say quite often, so I mean, it's getting boring, but I mean, I think this is the most exciting, but also the most scary moment in South Africa's storied railway history, because we had a fork in the road. We either find a path to investment into trains and infrastructure, and we find significant success on an industry that has been fundamentally restructured by government and has got a much, much better chance of long-term sustainability and success with competition across the network, for example. Or we don't, in which case it's a very, very scary time. You know, the reality is that the South African rail system needs billions of rands. If you go back to 2012, for example, Transnet spent 3.4 billion rand in maintenance. And for some reason, in 2013, they only spent 1.3 billion rand in maintenance, and the number, and this is in the Freight Rail Division, the number never recovered. So, you know, what that means is that over 12 years, you've got a with the impact of inflation. You've got about a 33 billion rand backlog in what should have been spent on maintenance and what wasn't spent on maintenance. So, you know, and then if you start taking the extrapolations across the network as to what needs to be spent, that 3 billion is actually quite a small number. We're looking at a much bigger number that needs to be invested. But the reality of railways is that railways are big business. So the ability to finance and fund these big investments into the infrastructure is very much there. You know, if you look at SANRAL, for example, SANRAL is looking to invest 48 billion rand into the extension of the N2 from Richards Bay through Vryheid, which is the line that is carrying a lot of coal at the moment because we're not moving it on trucks. You know, infrastructure is big, expensive. It does require big, expensive investment. And if you look in terms of international rail precedence, what we need to spend in South Africa is actually pretty small.
Do we have the skills to, you know, it's one thing to maintain and spend money on maintenance, but you also need presumably quite a lot of skill to understand what maintenance you need to do and the sequencing, whatever it might be. I mean, does Transnet have those skills still? It seems so depleted sometimes. And I mean this, I don't mean this, you know, nastily about Transnet. I'm sure they're doing their best, but it's all, you know, it seems so exhausted.
Without ever having spent 1 minute of my working life within Transnet, and because we're a South African business that runs African railways, I've had almost no experience of running trains on the core network in South Africa, and very little exposure to Transnet. It's very hard to comment from outside onto the skills position.
That might be why you're so optimistic.
In my business, we battle with skills all the time, to put it to the perspective. We spend on average 45,000 rand per person per year on training. So effectively pushing people through a postgraduate university degree every single year on maintenance on training in order to be able to sustain what has been some significant growth.
Jamie, as you say, this has been talked about now for a long time. Ever since Cyril Ramaphosa became president, he's been sort of on this reform path. And first steps taken, as you say, in 2022. It's now 2025. It's all taking a terribly long time. Electricity, when you think about it, was relatively easy. You know, it was simply to say to private sector producers, do what you want. There's no limit anymore on what you can do. With Transnet, it's a much more complex thing, much more difficult. And at the end of the railway line is still a port, presumably, that you have to... So, you know, wherever you're taking your goods to has to be ready to receive them. And by all accounts, our ports and our restructuring of our ports is being terribly slow. And while some of the waiting times might have moved slightly, we still run some of the most inefficient ports in the world. And, you know, how much difference can a decent railway system make while the end bit of it, you know, the last mile, as it were, isn't working?
You know, we need to break the South African rail system down, and this answer will take a couple of minutes, but so apologies. But, you know, we need to break the South African rail system down into its different parts, okay? There are really two parts to the South African freight rail system. The one is bulk freight, okay, and the other is general freight. Bulk freight is the movement of products like coal, iron ore, manganese, chrome, ferrochrome, and similar products. Okay, and they make up more than two thirds, or approximately two thirds, of the total rail volumes that are moved in South Africa. But they only use about somewhere between, depending on whose definition of total rail track you use, they only traverse about 15 to 20% of the total network. So two-thirds of total volumes only move in about 15 to 20% of the total network.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And there we run very heavy, very long trains. Okay. And then you've got the general freight networks, which is stuff like containers, cars, agri products, etc. Okay. And they use the bulk majority of the rail track. Okay. Where we are at the moment, with a system that is not operating as efficiently as it should, with operators like ourselves accepting that we need to absorb a certain level of network inefficiency. So in other words, our trains shouldn't be operating as efficiently as they should, and we shouldn't be invoicing them as many times as we should in a month. What it means really is that the bulk freight systems in South Africa are investable, in our opinion. We spent the last 4 years doing business cases. And in those business cases, we factored into account some of the inefficiencies that we will encounter, like offloading times that are a bit longer than what they should be. Of course, some bulk freight operates to world-class facilities, like the Richards Bay Coal Terminal, for example, or Packer Port private operations, where we can offload trains very, very effectively too. So it's not across the board. But we believe that investment into trains for the bulk sector is feasible. And we are talking about investment into trains of tens of billions of rands for that sector, okay? In order to get the general freight business to work in South Africa, that's lines like your container corridor between Johannesburg and Durban, the Cape Corridor between Johannesburg and Cape Town. To get those kind of lines really working, we're going to have to see the network really upgraded so that our trains can operate a lot quicker, they can turn a lot quicker. What's interesting, if you go back to our North American example, North American railways used to move largely bulk volumes, and they've pivoted to general freight cargoes, and they're moving them extremely efficiently and extremely profitably. So it absolutely can be done, especially with modern technologies. But the focus for the near future into the investment of trains into South Africa is going to be into the bulk markets. Now, for the bulk, and that's because there's a huge delta in price between road and rail for the bulk markets. For general freight, the road markets are extremely competitive. To give you a sense of the price delta, it's about plus minus, okay, about 250 rand a ton for to move coal across the South African rail system, and it's somewhere between two and a half and four times that much to move it on a truck. Okay, so there's a big price delta between road and rail for bulk freight in South Africa.
Yeah.
And we move significant volumes of bulk freight, and increasing the volumes we move of bulk freight in South Africa is going to protect our roads significantly, of course, on one hand, but create huge economic growth opportunities in the upstream economy in the other, and great opportunities for rail operators like ourselves as well. And so there really are very good opportunities for investment into the near future in significant trade sets for South Africa, for the bulk market.
So when you look at concessions now, are you the bulk trains, the bulk business is going to be more attractive, is what you're telling me? I mean, that's where the private sector is going to want to go, or can you make a go of general freight as well?
You know, it doesn't mean they don't exist, but I haven't we haven't found a business case that really, really works for the general freight market at the moment, given the cycle times. Cycle times means the amount of times you can invoice your train, for general freight. But the bulk market, like I said, is it's a huge market of unserviced freight at the moment. So it's in everybody's interest. Unserviced freight becomes serviced. Even with the explosion of the number of trucks moving manganese, coal, iron ore, chrome and ferrochrome, there still is a huge unserviced market in South Africa, which is just economic opportunity forgotten. Yeah. But it's in everybody's interest that starts to move.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was going on earlier on about how slow this all seems to be. And reading the network statement, and I even got into some of the annexures, I got to one point where, and you tell me whether I'm reading this right, but I read in one of the annexes that after all the work of this statement and the expectation that it's aroused, and, you know, there's a lot of expectation now out in the air. People, politicians are hyping it and everybody's excited. But I read this as Transnet is proposing to concession only one slot per corridor per week, which seems to, that's one train a week. If you got a concession, Joburg to Durban, which is general freight, I understand, you'd be able to run one train a week. Have I read that right? And is that reasonable?
So, Peter, unfortunately, you are reading that right. You know, and I need to preface this by saying we've come a long way, okay? But you are reading that right, okay? And to put it into context for you, okay, the container corridor, or what used to be known as the NATCO line, the 710 kilometers that links City Deep with Bay at Johannesburg with Durban, okay? It's a double lane the whole way. That has got 72 slots per direction per day, okay, as it's designed. So 144 slots a day, times that by 7, you get 1,008. So 1,008 slots per week on the...
You get one.
On the container corridor, to put you into perspective what the South African rail system was designed to handle. Okay, the Northern Corridor, the RBCT line, was designed for 48 slots per direction per day. It kind of gives you a sense of how much capacity there is in the South African rail system, and the five slots then obviously is a challenge. But it's also been released as five slots a week, okay, which means that if you run your train, let's say on one of the slots that's been made available, Phalaborwa to Maputo, for example,
yeah,
and then you complete your train trip within, say, 4 days, it means your train would have to sit and wait for 3 days for the slot to become available. It's very rare around the world that trains neatly operate within a weekly slot environment. So that also doesn't allow you to optimize the trains. And then the transit times are also slower than what we would have anticipated the transit times should be. So I think it's even in that annexure where it says what the transit time should be and what they're willing to say that transit time is. But then we've got another challenge, actually, in which we'll also work now in the process of resolving these. And I'm very confident that we will resolve these in the coming weeks.
Who will do the resolving?
Service Devo, the regulator. It comes back to the importance of having a regulator. And is the service level commitment. Because the under the terms that were released into the network statement, there's no commitment to actually providing a service to a level, to a certain level, which is very, very important that we resolve in the process of making this document really what it can be, really transformational for the regional railways and for the economy.
There's another document that they keep referring to in the network statement that I don't think has appeared yet, which is typically for South Africa, a national rail master plan. What is the master plan? What are we waiting for here?
So that Department of Transport is working at the moment on two final pieces of legislation to cement the reforms and the processes of reform around the railways. It's the master plan and the rail transportation bill. But what is interesting is when third-party access, which is what the network statement has now gazetted, was first announced by President Ramaphosa in the Economic Reconstruction and Recovery Bill, which I think was in October 2020 after the impact of COVID. And he announced that third-party trains would be allowed onto the national network. As the Rail Association, we went and got a legal opinion from one of our South Africa's big law firms into what was needed to change in terms of regulation and law to allow transit to contract private trains to operate on the network. And the answer was nothing. So in other words, for multiple generations, we could have been having private trains up to the network.
Yeah.
But, you know, what seems like a slow process from that time of 2020 up until today, the government has had to be able to set rail reform and a process that enables it to be long-term sustainable. And I'm actually in it may be surprising you, I'm in a camp that actually says rail reform has been happening really quickly. Given the amount of change that had to happen, it's a monopoly that's existed for 100 years. You know, to change that has been really economically, politically, from a regulation perspective, a lot has had to be considered.
Yet it took so little to break it, didn't it? You know, with the trucking industry just coming out of nowhere and just blasting a hole right through the sort of edifice of this monopoly. You know, this great big powerful Transnet that used to be.
It wasn't the truckers, Peter. It was just maintenance.
Really?
It was just maintenance. It comes back to the day that you decide to defer maintenance in a heavy infrastructure industry like ourselves, the day you pull back on maintenance is the day that you ascribe yourself to failure. And the day we started pulling back from maintenance, the South African rail system was the day we accepted that the industry was going to come under duress at some stage.
Oh, wow.
And truckers have picked up the slack in terms of volumes that are no longer being moved in the railways.
Yeah.
Give those customers the opportunity to move back into the railways. I think those customers would move back very quickly. And if you talk to the Road Freight Association, people like the Road Freight Association, for example, then they are enormously in favor of rail reform because they believe that the current trucking environment is not sustainable.
Yeah.
And the and if you also look at the way that freight moves internationally, you have rail that moves the big, heavy, long-haul bulk systems, and you have road that does the regional distribution and the intelligent logistics. The railroads and road operate hand in glove around the world. It's a relationship that when it's operating effectively is extremely powerful.
James, when do you think you'll first put a train onto a Transnet track and carry a load from Joburg to Durban or from Cape Town to Gqeberha? Give us a realistic date.
The opportunity for us to redeploy one of our trains out of the services that we operate elsewhere in the continent, of course, and move it into South Africa is something that's relatively easy for us to do. It would probably be a good idea because we can start to learn some of the operational challenges that we might encounter. It would be a good thing, I think, for us to do, but it's going to be economically irrelevant for South Africa. Okay, one private train operating is economically irrelevant for South Africa.
But yeah.
The real question that I think we have to ask is, when is the first private sector orders going to be placed for new trains to significantly amplify the amount of rail freight that moves in South Africa? Okay.
Yeah.
And my answer to that is, as soon as these final issues, some of which I've highlighted on the call today, are resolved in the network statement. And I really sincerely believe, because there's a huge amount of appetite from government to make sure that this happens. We've got the benefit of a regulator. We've got leadership of Transnet that I believe is committed to getting this right. I truly believe that's going to be this year. We have, as a company, spent a lot of time looking at the feasibility of different rail flows. We're engaging with customers to commit to rail volumes. I know that the rail freight flows are feasible for certain commodities. And we've got customers that are willing to commit to us. Now we need train parts and the terms and conditions.
Just before we finish, James, how important is it to get there that you sort out the rather limited number of concessions or slots you're being offered at the moment in the current network statement? You've got to get that right before you commit your business to it, surely.
Absolutely. We have to get the appropriate number of slots opened up across the network. We have to get the tempo of those slots. So not weekly slots. The trains have to be optimally utilized across the network. And then we have to get the transit times right. If the transit times are too slow, you can't invoice enough, you can't pay back your debt, you can't declare shareholder. So, of course, we have to get those elements right, and then we have to get some of the terms and conditions of the access agreements right, and then we can... The good thing in South Africa, okay, the great thing in South Africa, so we've got a huge body of freight. You know, to put it into perspective how big the South African freight body is, okay? The whole Zambian and Tanzanian copper belt, okay? All of those copper trucks that you see on the N1 and the N3, for example, that operate to all of the regional ports, Dar es Salaam, Lobito, Walvis Bay, Beira, etc., okay? All of that copper that's exported, all of the mining reagents that goes back in, plus the project cargoes and general freight volumes, into that market is maximum an 8 million ton market. Okay.
Oh, wow.
ArcelorMittal on their own is more than a 10 million ton customer. The bulk freight market opportunity in South Africa is more than we believe is about 50 million tons.
James Holly, listen, thank you so much for that. Hey, I really appreciate it. We have to stop there. Thank you so much for coming on, and I hope we can do this again as things progress. And I'm sure we all wish you the best of luck in the months and years ahead. And thank you for listening. I hope that was instructive. I'll be back next week with another edition of Podcasts from the Edge. Please join me again. Until then, bye-bye and keep safe.